This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Neverwhere, the author's preferred text. Written and read by Neil Gaiman. Copyright 1996-1997, Neil Gaiman. This version of the text copyright 2005, Neil Gaiman. Production copyright 2007 by HarperCollins Publishers. Neverwhere. I have never been to St. John's Wood. I dare not. I should be afraid of the innumerable night of fir trees, afraid to come upon a blood-red cup and the beating of the wings of the eagle. The Napoleon of Notting Hill, G.K. Chesterton. If ever thou gavest hosen or shoon, then every night and all, sit thou down and put them on, and Christ receive thy soul. This I night, every night and all, fire and fleet and candlelight, and Christ receive thy soul. If ever thou gavest meat or drink, then every night and all, the fire shall never make thee shrink, and Christ receive thy soul. The like wake dirge. Traditional. Prologue. The night before he went to London, Richard Mayhew was not enjoying himself. He had begun the evening by enjoying himself. He had enjoyed reading the goodbye cards and receiving the hugs from several not entirely unattractive young ladies of his acquaintance. He had enjoyed the warnings about the evils and dangers of London, and the gift of the white umbrella with the map of the London Underground on it that the lads had clubbed together to buy him. He had enjoyed the first few pints of ale, but then, with each successive pint of ale, he found he was enjoying himself significantly less, until now he was sitting and shivering on the sidewalk outside the pub in a small Scottish town, weighing the conflicting merits of being sick and not being sick, and not enjoying himself at all. Inside the pub, Richard's friends continued to celebrate his forthcoming departure with an enthusiasm that, to Richard's way of thinking, was beginning to border on the sinister. He sat on the sidewalk and held on tightly to the rolled-up umbrella and wondered whether going south to London was really a good idea.
"You want to keep an eye out," said a cracked old voice. "They'll be moving you on before you can say Jack Robinson, or taking you in, I wouldn't be surprised."
Two sharp eyes stared out from a beaky, grimy face.
"You all right?"
"Yes, thank you," said Richard. He was a fresh-faced, boyish young man, with dark, slightly curly hair and large hazel eyes. He had a rumpled, just-woken-up look to him, which made him more attractive to the opposite sex than he would ever understand or believe. The grimy face softened.
"Here, poor thing," she said, and pushed a 50-pence piece into Richard's hand. "How long you been on the streets, then?"
"I'm not homeless," explained Richard, embarrassed, attempting to give the old woman her coin back.
"Please, take your money. I'm fine. I just came out here to get some air. I go to London tomorrow," he explained.
She peered down at him suspiciously, then took back her 50 pence and made it vanish beneath the layers of coats and shawls in which she was enveloped.
"I've been to London," she confided. "I was married in London, but he was a bad lot. Me mam told me not to go marrying outside, but I was young and beautiful, although you'd never credit it today, and I followed my heart."
"I'm sure you did," said Richard, embarrassed. The conviction that he was about to be sick was starting, slowly, to fade.
"Fat lot of good it done me. I've been homeless, so I know what it's like," said the old woman. "That's why I thought you was. What you going to London for?"
"I've got a job," he told her proudly.
"Doing what?"
she asked.
Securities," said Richard. "I was a dancer," said the old woman,
and she tottered awkwardly around the sidewalk, humming tunelessly to herself. Then she teetered from side to side like a spinning top coming to rest, and finally she stopped, facing Richard. "Hold out your hand," she told him, "and I'll tell your fortune." He did as he was told. She put her old hand into his and held it tightly, and then she blinked a few times, like an owl who had swallowed a mouse that was beginning to disagree with it. "You got a long way to go," she said, puzzled. "London," Richard told her. "Not just London." The old woman paused. "Not any London I know." It started to rain then, softly. "I'm sorry," she said. "It starts with doors."
"Doors?"
She nodded. The rain fell harder, pattering on the roofs and on the asphalt of the road.
"I'd watch out for doors if I were you."
Richard stood up a little unsteadily.
"All right," he said,
a little unsure of how one ought to treat information of this nature.
"I will. Thanks."
The pub door was opened, and light and noise spilled out into the street.
"Richard, you all right?"
"Yeah, I'm fine. I'll be back in a second."
The old lady was already wobbling down the street into the pelting rain, getting wet. Richard felt he had to do something for her. He couldn't give her money, though. He hurried after her, down the narrow street, the cold rain drenching his face and hair.
"Here,"
said Richard. He fumbled with the handle of the umbrella, trying to find the button that opened it. Then a click, and it blossomed into a huge white map of the London Underground network, each line drawn in a different colour, every station marked and named. The old woman took the umbrella, gratefully, and smiled her thanks.
"You've a good heart," she told him. "Sometimes that's enough to see you safe wherever you go."
Then she shook her head.
"But mostly it's not."
She clutched the umbrella tightly, as a gust of wind threatened to tug it away from her or pull it inside out. She wrapped her arms around it and bent almost double against the rain and the wind. Then she walked away into the rain and the night, a round white shape covered with the names of London tube stations, Earl's Court, Marble Arch, Blackfriars, White City, Victoria, Angel, Oxford Circus. Richard found himself pondering, drunkenly, whether there really was a circus at Oxford Circus, a real circus with clowns and beautiful women and dangerous beasts. The pub door opened once more, a blast of sound as if the pub's volume control had just been turned up high.
"Richard, you wanker, it's your bloody party and you're missing all the fun."
He walked back in the pub, the urge to be sick lost in all the oddness.
"You look like a drowned rat,"
said someone.
"You've never seen a drowned rat," said Richard. Someone else handed him a large whiskey.
"Here, get that down you. That'll warm you up. You know, you won't be able to get real scotch in London."
"I'm sure I will," sighed Richard. Water was dripping from his hair into his drink. "They have everything in London." And he downed the scotch, and after that someone bought him another. And then the evening blurred and broke up into fragments, and afterward he remembered only the sense that he was leaving somewhere small and sensible that made sense, for somewhere huge and old that didn't. And vomiting interminably into a gutter flowing with rainwater, somewhere in the small hours of the morning. And a white shape, marked with strange coloured symbols like a little round beetle, walking away from him in the rain. The next morning, Richard got on the train to London, for the 6-hour journey south that would bring him to the strange Gothic spires and arches of St. Pancras Station. His mother gave him a small walnut cake that she had made for the journey and a thermos flask filled with tea. And Richard Mayhew went to London, feeling like hell. Chapter 1. She had been running for 4 days now, a harum-scarum tumbling flight through passages and tunnels. She was hungry and exhausted and more tired than a body could stand, and each successive door was proving harder to open. After 4 days of flight, she had found a hiding place, a tiny stone burrow under the world, where she would be safe, or so she prayed, and at last she slept. Mr. Croup had hired Ross at the last floating market, which had been held in Westminster Abbey. "Think of him," he told Mr. Vandemar, "as a canary."
"Sings?" asked Mr. Vandemar.
"I doubt it. I sincerely and utterly doubt it."
Mr. Croup ran a hand through his lank orange hair.
"No, my fine friend, I was thinking metaphorically, more along the lines of the birds they take down mines."
Mr. Vandemar nodded, comprehension dawning slowly. Yes, a canary. Mr. Ross had no other resemblance to a canary. He was huge, almost as big as Mr. Vandemar, and extremely grubby and quite hairless, and he said very little, although he had made a point of telling each of them that he liked to kill things, and he was good at it. And this amused Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar, much as Genghis Khan might have been amused by the swagger of a young Mongol who had recently pillaged his first village or burnt his first yurt. He was a canary, and he never knew it. So Mr. Ross went first in his filthy T-shirt and his crusted blue jeans, and Croup and Vandemar walked behind him in their elegant black suits. There are four simple ways for the observant to tell Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar apart. First, Mr. Vandemar is 2.5 heads taller than Mr. Croup. Second, Mr. Croup has eyes of a faded china blue, while Mr. Vandemar's eyes are brown. Third, while Mr. Vandemar fashioned the rings he wears on his right hand out of the skulls of four ravens, Mr. Croup has no obvious jewellery. Fourth, Mr. Croup likes words, while Mr. Vandemar is always hungry. Also, they look nothing at all alike. A rustle in the tunnel darkness. Mr. Vandemar's knife was in his hand, and then it was no longer in his hand, and it was quivering gently almost 30 feet away. He walked over to his knife and picked it up by the hilt. There was a grey rat impaled on the blade, its mouth opening and closing impotently as the life fled. He crushed its skull between finger and thumb.
"Now, there's one rat that won't be telling any more tales," said Mr. Croup.
He chuckled at his own joke. Mr. Vandemar did not respond.
"Rat tails, get it?"
Mr. Vandemar pulled the rat from the blade and began to munch on it thoughtfully, head first. Mr. Croup slapped it out of his hands.
"Stop that," he said.
Mr. Vandemar put his knife away, a little sullenly.
"Back up,"
hissed Mr. Croup encouragingly.
"There will always be another rat. Now, onward. Things to do, people to damage."
3 years in London had not changed Richard, although it had changed the way he perceived the city. Richard had originally imagined London as a grey city, even a black city, from pictures he had seen, and was surprised to find it filled with colour. It was a city of red brick and white stone, red buses and large black taxis, which were often, to Richard's initial puzzlement, gold or green or maroon, bright red postboxes and green grassy parks and cemeteries. It was a city in which the very old and the awkwardly new jostled each other, not uncomfortably, but without respect. A city of shops and offices and restaurants and homes, of parks and churches, of ignored monuments and remarkably unpalatial palaces. A city of hundreds of districts with strange names, Crouch End, Chalk Farm, Earl's Court, Marble Arch, and oddly distinct identities. A noisy, dirty, cheerful, troubled city which fed on tourists, needed them as it despised them, in which the average speed of transportation through the city had not increased in 300 years, following 500 years of fitful road widening and unskillful compromises between the needs of traffic, whether horse-drawn or more recently motorized, and the needs of pedestrians, a city inhabited by and teeming with people of every colour and manner and kind. When he had first arrived, he had found London huge, odd, fundamentally incomprehensible,
With only the tube map, that elegant, multicoloured topographical display of underground railway lines and stations giving it any semblance of order. Gradually, he realised that the tube map was a handy fiction that made life easier, but bore no resemblance to the reality of the shape of the city above. Like belonging to a political party, he thought once proudly, and then, having tried to explain the resemblance between the tube map and politics at a party to a cluster of bewildered strangers, he had decided in the future to leave political comment to others. He continued, slowly, by a process of osmosis and white knowledge, which is like white noise, only more informative, to comprehend the city, a process which accelerated when he realized that the actual city of London itself was no bigger than a square mile, stretching from Aldgate in the east to Fleet Street and the law courts of the Old Bailey in the west. A tiny municipality, now home to London's financial institutions, and that was where it had all begun. 2,000 years before, London had been a little Celtic village on the north shore of the Thames, which the Romans had encountered and settled in. London had grown, slowly, until roughly 1,000 years later it met the tiny royal city of Westminster immediately to the west, and once London Bridge had been built, London met the town of Southwark, directly across the river. And it continued to grow, fields and woods and marshlands slowly vanishing beneath the flourishing town, and it continued to expand, encountering other little villages and hamlets as it grew, like Whitechapel and Deptford to the east, Hammersmith and Shepherd's Bush to the west, Camden and Islington in the north, Battersea and Lambeth across the Thames to the south, absorbing all of them as it grew, just as a pool of mercury encounters and incorporates smaller beads of mercury, leaving only their names behind. London grew into something huge and contradictory. It was a good place and a fine city. But there is a price to be paid for all good places, and a price that all good places have to pay. After a while, Richard found himself taking London for granted. In time, he began to pride himself on having visited none of the sights of London, except for the Tower of London, when his Aunt Maud came down to the city for a weekend, and Richard found himself her reluctant escort. But Jessica changed all that. Richard found himself on otherwise sensible weekends accompanying her to places like the National Gallery and the Tate Gallery, where he learned that walking around museums too long hurts your feet, that the great art treasures of the world all blur into each other after a while, and that it is almost beyond the human capacity for belief to accept how much museum cafeterias will brazenly charge for a slice of cake and a cup of tea.
"Here's your tea and your eclair," he told her. "It would have cost less to buy one of those Tintorettos."
"Don't exaggerate," said Jessica cheerfully. "Anyway, there aren't any Tintorettos at the Tate."
"I should have had that cherry cake," said Richard. "Then they would have been able to afford another Van Gogh."
"No," said Jessica accurately, "they wouldn't." Richard had met Jessica in France on a weekend break in Paris 2 years earlier. Had, in fact, discovered her in the Louvre while trying to find the group of his office friends who had organized the trip. Staring up at an immense sculpture, he had stepped backwards into Jessica, who was admiring an extremely large and historically important diamond. He tried to apologize to her in French, which he did not speak, and so gave up and began to apologize in English, and then tried to attempt to apologize in French for his having to apologize in English, until he noticed that Jessica was about as English as it was possible for any one person to be, by which time she had him buy her an expensive French sandwich and some overpriced fizzy apple juice by way of apology. And, well, that was the start of it all, really. He had never been able to convince Jessica that he wasn't the kind of person who went to art galleries after that. On weekends, when they did not go to art galleries or to museums, Richard would trail behind Jessica as she went shopping, which she did, on the whole, in affluent Knightsbridge, a short walk and an even shorter taxi ride from her flat in a Kensington mews. Richard would accompany Jessica on her tours of such huge and intimidating emporia as Harrods and Harvey Nichols, stores where Jessica was able to purchase anything from jewellery to books to the week's groceries. Richard had been awed by Jessica, who was beautiful and often quite funny, and was certainly going somewhere. And Jessica saw in Richard an enormous amount of potential, which, properly harnessed by the right woman, would have made him the perfect matrimonial accessory. If only he were a little more focused, she would murmur to herself. And so she gave him books with titles like Dress for Success and 125 Habits of Successful Men, and books on how to run a business like a military campaign. And Richard always said thank you and always meant to read them. In Harvey Nichols' men's fashion department, she would pick out for him the kinds of clothes she thought that he should wear. And he wore them, during the week anyway. And a year to the day after their first encounter, she told him she thought it time that they went shopping for an engagement ring. "Why'd you go out with her?" asked Gary in corporate accounts 18 months later. "She's terrifying." Richard shook his head. "She's really sweet, once you get to know her." Gary put down the plastic troll he had picked up from Richard's desk. "I'm surprised she still lets you play with these." "The subject has never come up," said Richard, picking up one of the creatures from his desk. It had a shock of day-glow orange hair and a slightly baffled expression, as if it were lost. The subject had indeed come up. Jessica had, however, convinced herself that Richard's troll collection was a mark of endearing eccentricity, comparable to Mr. Stockton's collection of angels. Jessica was in the process of organizing a traveling exhibition of Mr. Stockton's angel collection and had come to the conclusion that great men always collected something. In actuality, Richard did not really collect trolls. He'd found a troll on the street outside the office, and in a vague and pretty vain attempt at injecting a little personality into his working world, he had placed it on his computer monitor. The others had followed over the next few months, gifts from colleagues who had noticed that Richard had a penchant for the ugly little creatures. He had taken the gifts and positioned them strategically about his desk, beside the telephones and the framed photograph of Jessica. Today, the photograph had a yellow post-it note stuck to it. It was a Friday afternoon. Richard had noticed that events were cowards. They didn't occur singly, but instead they would run in packs and leap out at him all at once. Take this particular Friday, for example. It was, as Jessica had pointed out to him at least a dozen times in the last month, the most important day of his life. Not the most important day of her life, of course. That would come one day in the future, when, Richard had no doubt, they would make her Prime Minister, or Queen, or God. But it was, without question, the most important day of his life. And so it was unfortunate that, despite the post-it note Richard had left on his fridge door at home, and the other post-it note he had placed on the photograph of Jessica on his desk, he had forgotten about it completely and utterly. Also, there was the Wandsworth report, which was overdue and taking up most of his head. Richard checked another row of figures, then he noticed that page 17 had vanished, and he set it up to print out again, and another page down, and he knew that if he were only left alone to finish it, if, miracle of miracles, the phone did not ring, it rang. He thumbed the speakerphone. "Hello, Richard? The managing director needs to know when he'll have the report." Richard looked at his watch. "A 5 minutes, Sylvia. It's almost wrapped up. I just have to attach the P&L projection." "Thanks, Dick. I'll come down for it." Sylvia was, as she liked to explain, the MD's PA. And she moved in an atmosphere of crisp efficiency. He thumbed the speakerphone off. It rang again, immediately. "Richard," said the speaker, with Jessica's voice. "It's Jessica. You haven't forgotten, have you?" "Forgotten?" He tried to remember what he could have forgotten. He looked at Jessica's photograph for inspiration and found all the inspiration he could have needed in the shape of a yellow post-it note stuck to her forehead. "Richard, pick up the telephone." He picked up the phone, reading the post-it note as he did so. "Sorry, Jess. No, I hadn't forgotten. 7 p.m. at Ma Maison Italiano. Should I meet you there?"
"Jessica Richard, not Jess."
She paused for a moment.
"After what happened last time, I don't think so. You really could get lost in your own back garden, Richard."
Richard contemplated pointing out that anyone could have confused the National Gallery with the National Portrait Gallery, and that it wasn't she who had spent the whole day standing in the rain, which was, in his opinion, every bit as much fun as walking around either place until his feet hurt. But he felt better of it.
"I'll meet you at your place," said Jessica. "We can walk down together."
"Right, Jess. Jessica, sorry.
You have confirmed our reservation, haven't you, Richard?"
"Yes," lied Richard earnestly. The other phone on his desk had begun to ring shrilly.
"Jessica, look, I..."
"Good," said Jessica, and she broke the connection. The largest amount of money Richard had ever spent on anything had been spent on Jessica's engagement ring, 18 months earlier, at one of Harrod's many jewellery concessions. He picked up the other phone.
"Hi, Dick,"
said Gary.
"It's me, Gary."
Gary sat a few desks down from Richard. He waved at Richard from his own, gleamingly troll-free desk.
"Are we still on for drinks? You said we could go over the Merstham account."
"Get off the bloody phone, Gary. Of course we are."
Richard put down the phone. There was a telephone number at the bottom of the post-it note. Richard had written the post-it note to himself several weeks earlier, and he had made the reservation. He was almost certain of that, but he had not confirmed it. He had kept meaning to, but there had been so much to do, and Richard had known that there was plenty of time. But events run in packs. Sylvia was now standing next to him.
"Dick, the Wandsworth report?"
"Almost ready, Sylvia.
Look, just hold on a sec, can you?"
He finished punching in the number, breathed a sigh of relief when somebody answered,
"Ma maison, can I help you?"
"Yes," said Richard. "A table for three for tonight. I think I booked it. And if I did, I'm confirming the reservation. And if I didn't, I wondered if I could book it. Please."
No, they had no record of a table for tonight in the name of Mayhew, or Stockton, or Bartram, Jessica's surname. And as for booking a table, it wasn't the words that Richard found so unpleasant. It was the tone of voice in which the information was transmitted.
"A table for tonight should certainly have been booked years before, perhaps," it was implied, "by Richard's parents. A table for tonight was impossible. If the Pope, the Prime Minister, and the President of France arrived this evening without a confirmed reservation, even they would be turned out into the street with a continental jeer. But as for my fiancé's boss, I know I should have phoned before. There are only three of us. Can't you please..."
They had put down the phone. "Richard," said Sylvia, "the MD's waiting."
"Do you think," asked Richard, "they'd give me a table if I phoned back and offered them extra money?"
In her dream, they were all together in the house. Her parents, her brother, her baby sister. They were standing together in the ballroom, staring at her. They were all so pale, so grave. Portia, her mother, touched her cheek and told her that she was in danger. In her dream, Dora laughed and said she knew. Her mother shook her head. "No, no, now she was in danger. Now!" Dora opened her eyes. The door was opening quietly, quietly. She held her breath. Footsteps, quiet on the stone. "Perhaps he won't notice me," she thought. "Perhaps he'll go away." And then she thought, desperately, "I'm hungry." The footsteps hesitated. She was well hidden, she knew, under a pile of newspapers and rags. And it was possible that the intruder meant her no harm. "Can't he hear my heartbeat?" she thought. And then the footsteps came closer, and she knew what she had to do, and it scared her. A hand pulled the covers off her, and she looked up into a blank, utterly hairless face, which creased into a vicious smile. She rolled then, and twisted, and the knife blade aimed at her chest caught her in the upper arm. Until that moment, she had never thought she could do it. Never thought she would be brave enough, or scared enough, or desperate enough to dare. But she reached up one hand to his chest, and she opened. He gasped and tumbled onto her. It was wet and warm and slippery, and she slithered and staggered out from under the man, and she stumbled out of the room. She caught her breath in the tunnel outside, narrow and low, as she fell against the wall, breathing in gasps and sobs. That had taken the last of her strength. Now she was spent. Her shoulder was beginning to throb. The knife, she thought. But she was safe. "My, oh my," said a voice from the darkness on her right. "She survived Mr. Ross. Well, I never, Mr. Vandemar." The voice oozed. It sounded like grey slime. "Well, I never either, Mr. Croup," said a flat voice on her left. A light was kindled and flickered. "Still," said Mr. Croup, his eyes gleaming in the dark beneath the earth. "She won't survive us." Dor kneed him hard in the groin, and then she began randomly to run, her right hand holding her left shoulder. And she ran. "Dick!" Richard waved away the interruption. Life was almost under his control now, just a little more time. "Gerry," said his name again. "Dick, it's 6:30. "It's what?" Papers and pens and spreadsheets and trolls were tumbled into Richard's briefcase. He snapped it shut and ran. He pulled his coat on as he went. Gary was following. "Are we going to have that drink then?" "Drink? We were meant to be getting together this evening to talk about the Mersim account, remember?" "That was tonight." Richard paused for a moment. If ever, he decided, they made disorganisation an Olympic sport, he could be disorganised for Britain. "Gary," he said, "I'm sorry, I blew it. I have to see Jessica tonight. We're taking her boss out to dinner." "Mr. Stockton? Of Stockton's? The Stockton?" Richard nodded. They hurried down the stairs. "I'm sure you'll have fun," said Gary insincerely. "And how is the creature from the Black Lagoon?" "Jessica's from Ilford, actually, Gary. And she remains the light and love of my life. Thank you very much for asking." By which time they were in the lobby, and Richard made a dart for the automatic doors, which spectacularly failed to open. 6:08, Mr. Mayhew," said Mr. Figgis, the building's security guard. "You have to sign out." "I don't need this," said Richard, "to no one in particular. I really don't." Mr. Figgis smelt vaguely of medicinal liniment and was widely rumoured to have an encyclopaedic collection of softcore pornography. He guarded the doors with a diligence that bordered upon madness, never quite having lived down the evening when an entire floor's worth of computer equipment upped and left, along with two potted palms and the managing director's Axminster carpet. "So our drink's off, then?" "I'm sorry, Gary. Is Monday okay for you?"
"Sure.
Monday's fine. See you Monday." Mr. Figgis
inspected their signatures and satisfied himself they had no computers, potted palms or carpets about their persons. Then he pressed a button under his desk and the door slid open.
"Doors," said Richard.
The underway branched and divided. She picked her way at random, ducking through tunnels, running and stumbling and weaving. Behind her strolled Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar, as calmly and cheerfully as Victorian dignitaries visiting the Crystal Palace exhibition. When they arrived at a crossroads, Mr. Croup would kneel and find the nearest spot of blood, and they would follow it. They were like hyenas, exhausting their prey. They could wait. They had all the time in the world.
Luck was with Richard for a change. He caught a black taxi, driven by a particularly enthusiastic taxi driver who took Richard home by an unlikely route involving streets Richard had never previously noticed while holding forth, as Richard had discovered all London taxi drivers will hold forth, given a living, breathing, English-speaking passenger, on London's inner-city traffic problems, how best to deal with crime, and thorny political issues of the day. Richard jumped out of the cab, leaving a tip and his briefcase behind, managed to flag down the cab again before it made it into the main road and so got his briefcase back. Then he ran up the stairs and into his flat. He was already shedding clothes as he entered the hall. His briefcase spun across the room and crash-landed on the sofa. He took his keys from his pocket and placed them carefully on the hall table in order to ensure he did not forget them. Then he dashed into the bedroom. The buzzer sounded. Richard, three-quarters of the way into his best suit, launched himself at the entry phone. "Richard, it's Jessica. I hope you're ready." "Oh, yes. Be right down." He pulled on a coat and he ran, slamming the door behind him. Jessica was waiting for him at the bottom of the stairs. She always waited for him there. Jessica didn't like Richard's flat. It made her feel uncomfortably female. There was always the chance of finding a pair of Richard's underwear, well, anywhere. Not to mention the wandering lumps of congealed toothpaste on the bathroom sink. No, it was not a Jessica kind of place. Jessica was very beautiful. So much so, Richard would occasionally find himself staring at her, wondering, how did she end up with me? And when they made love, which they did at Jessica's Muse flat in fashionable Kensington, in Jessica's brass bed with the crisp white linen sheets, for Jessica's parents had told her that eiderdowns were decadent. In the darkness, afterwards, she would hold him very tightly, and her long brown curls would tumble over his chest, and she would whisper to him how much she loved him, and he would tell her he loved her and always wanted to be with her, and they both believed it to be true. "Bless me, Mr. Vandemar. She's slowing up."
"Slowing up, Mr. Croup?"
"She must be losing a lot of blood, Mr. V."
"Lovely blood, Mr. C. Lovely wet blood."
"Not long now." A click. The sound of a switchblade opening, empty and lonely and dark.
"Richard, what are you doing?" asked Jessica.
"Nothing, Jessica." "You haven't forgotten your keys again, have you?"
"No, Jessica."
Richard stopped patting himself and pushed his hands deep into the pockets of his coat.
"Now, when you meet Mr. Stockton tonight," said Jessica, "you have to appreciate that he's not just a very important man. He's also a corporate entity in his own right."
"I can't wait," sighed Richard.
"What was that, Richard?"
"I can't wait," said Richard rather more enthusiastically.
"Oh, do step lively,"
said Jessica, who was beginning to exude an aura of what, in a lesser woman, might almost have been described as nerves.
"We mustn't keep Mr. Stockton waiting."
"No, Jess."
"Don't call me that, Richard. I loathe pet names. They're so demeaning."
"Spare any change?" The man sat in a doorway. His beard was yellow and grey, and his eyes were sunken and dark. A hand-lettered sign hung from a piece of frayed string around his neck and rested on his chest, telling anyone with the eyes to read it that he was homeless and hungry. It didn't take a sign to tell you that. Richard, hand already in his pocket, fumbled for a coin.
"Richard, we haven't got the time," said Jessica,
who gave to charity and invested ethically.
"Now, I do want you to make a good impression, fiancé-wise. It is vital that a future spouse makes a good impression."
And then her face creased, and she hugged him for a moment and said, "Oh, Richard, I do love you. You do know that, don't you?" And Richard nodded, and he did. Jessica checked her watch and increased her pace. Richard discreetly flicked a pound coin back through the air towards the man in the doorway, who caught it in one grimy hand.
"There wasn't any problem with the reservations, was there?" asked Jessica.
And Richard, who was not much good at lying when faced with a direct question, said,
"Ah."
She'd chosen wrongly. The corridor ended in a blank wall. Normally that would hardly have given her pause, but she was so tired, so hungry, in so much pain. She leaned against the wall, feeling the brick roughness against her face. She was gulping breath, hiccuping and sobbing. Her arm was cold, and her left hand was numb. She could go no further, and the world was beginning to feel very distant. She wanted to stop, to lie down and to sleep for 100 years.
"Oh, bless my little black soul, Mr. Vandermeer, do you see what I see?"
The voice was soft, close. They must have been nearer to her than she had imagined.
"I spy with my little eye something that's going to be..."
"Dead in a minute, Mr. Croup," said the flat voice from above her.
"Our principal will be delighted."
And the girl pulled whatever she could find deep inside her soul from all the pain and the hurt and the fear. She was spent, burnt out, and utterly exhausted. She had nowhere to go, no power left, no time. "If it's the last door I open," she prayed silently to the temple, to the arch.
"Somewhere, anywhere, safe."
And then she thought, wildly,
"Somebody."
And as she began to pass out, she tried to open a door. As the darkness took her, she heard Mr. Croup's voice as if from a long way away. It said,
"Bugger and blast."
Jessica and Richard walked down the street toward the restaurant. She had her arm through his and was walking as fast as her heels permitted. He hurried to keep up. Street lights and the fronts of closed stores illuminated their path. They passed a stretch of tall, looming buildings, abandoned and lonely, bounded by a high brick wall.
"You are honestly telling me you had to promise them an extra £50 for our table tonight? You are an idiot, Richard."
Jessica, dark eyes flashing, was not even slightly amused.
"They had lost my reservation, and they said all the tables were booked."
Their steps echoed off the high walls. "They'll probably have a sitting by the kitchen," sighed Jessica.
"Oh, or the door. Did you tell them it was for Mr. Stockton?"
"Yes," replied Richard. Jessica sighed. She continued to drag him along as a door opened in the wall a little way ahead of them,
and someone stepped out and stood swaying for one long, terrible moment and then collapsed to the concrete. Richard shivered and stopped in his tracks. Jessica tugged him into motion.
"Now, when you're talking to Mr. Stockton, you must make sure you don't interrupt him or disagree with him. He doesn't like to be disagreed with. When he makes a joke, laugh. If you're in any doubt as to whether or not he's made a joke, look at me. I'll tap my forefinger."
They'd reached the person on the sidewalk. Jessica stepped over the crumpled form. Richard hesitated.
"Jessica?" "You're right. He might think I'm bored," she mused. "I know," she said brightly. "If he makes a joke, I'll rub my earlobe." "Jessica?"
He could not believe she was simply ignoring the figure at their feet.
"What?"
She was not pleased to be jerked out of her reverie.
"Look!"
He pointed to the sidewalk. The person was face down and enveloped in bulky clothes. Jessica took his arm and tugged him towards her.
"Oh, I see. If you pay them any attention, Richard, they'll walk all over you. They all have homes, really. Once she's slept it off, I'm sure she'll be fine."
"She?" Richard looked down. It was a girl. Jessica continued.
"Now, I've told Mr. Stockton that we..."
Richard was down on one knee. "Richard, what are you doing?"
"She isn't drunk," said Richard. "She's hurt."
He looked at his fingertips. She's bleeding.
Jessica looked down at him, nervous and puzzled. We're going to be late, she pointed out.
She's hurt.
Jessica looked back at the girl on the sidewalk. Priorities. Richard had no priorities.
Richard, we're going to be late. Someone else will be along. Someone else will help her.
The girl's face was crusted with dirt, and her clothes were wet with blood. She's hurt, he said simply. There was an expression on his face that Jessica hadn't seen before. Richard, she warned. And then she relented a little and offered a compromise.
Dial 999 and call an ambulance then. Quickly now.
Suddenly the girl's eyes opened white and wide in a face that was little more than a smudge of dust and blood.
Not a hospital. Please, they'll find me. Take me somewhere safe. Please.
Her voice was weak.
You're bleeding,
said Richard. He looked to see where she had come from, but the wall was blank and brick and unbroken. He looked back to her still form and asked,
Why not a hospital?
Help me. The girl whispered, and her eyes closed. Again he asked her, Why don't you want to go to the hospital? This time there was no answer at all.
When you call the ambulance, said Jessica, don't give your name. You might have to make a statement or something, and then we'd be late, and I'm not having this evening ruined by...
Richard, what are you doing? Richard had picked the girl up, cradling her in his arms. She was surprisingly light.
I'm taking her back to my place, Jess. I can't just leave her. Tell Mr. Stockton I'm really sorry, but it was an emergency. I'm sure he'll understand.
Richard Oliver Mayhew, said Jessica coldly. You put that young person down and come back here this minute, or this engagement is at an end as of now. I'm warning you. Richard felt the sticky warmth of blood soaking into his shirt. Sometimes, he realized, there is nothing you can do. He walked away. Jessica stood there on the sidewalk, watching him ruin her big evening, and her eyes stung with tears. After a while, he was out of sight, and then, and only then, did she say, loudly and distinctly and unladylike, Shit! And fling her handbag as hard as she could onto the ground, hard enough to scatter her mobile phone and her lipstick and her diary and a handful of tampons across the concrete. And then, because there was nothing else to do, she picked them all up and put them back into her handbag and walked back down to the restaurant to wait for Mr. Stockton. Later, as she sipped her white wine, she tried to come up with plausible reasons why her fiancé was not with her and found herself wondering desperately whether or not she could simply claim that Richard was dead.
It was very sudden,
said Jessica wistfully under her breath. Richard did not, at any point on his walk, stop to think. It was not something over which he had any volition. Somewhere in the sensible part of his head, someone, a normal, sensible Richard Mayhew, was telling him how ridiculous he was being, that he should have just called the police or an ambulance, that it was dangerous to lift an injured person, that he had really, seriously, properly upset Jessica, that he was going to have to sleep on the sofa tonight, that he was spoiling his only really good suit, that the girl smelled quite dreadful. But Richard found himself placing one foot in front of the other, and, arms cramping and back hurting and ignoring the looks he got from the passers-by, he just kept walking. And after a while, he was at the ground floor door of his building, and he was stumbling up the staircase, and then he was standing in front of the door to his flat and realizing that he had left his keys on the hall table inside. The girl reached out one filthy hand to the door, and it swung open. Never thought I'd be pleased that the door hadn't latched properly, thought Richard, and he carried the girl in, closing the door behind him with his foot, and put her down on his bed. His shirt front was soaked in blood. She seemed semi-conscious. Her eyes were closed, but fluttering. He peeled off her leather jacket. There was a long cut on her left upper arm and shoulder. Richard caught his breath.
"Look, I'm going to call a doctor," he said quietly. "Can you hear me?"
Her eyes opened wide and scared.
"Please, no. It'll be fine. It's not as bad as it looks. I just need sleep. No doctors." "But your arm, your shoulder." "I'll be fine. Tomorrow? Please?"
It was little more than a whisper. "I suppose, all right." And with sanity beginning to assert itself, he said, "Look, can I ask?" But she was asleep. Richard took an old school scarf from his closet and wrapped it firmly around her left upper arm and shoulder. He did not want her to bleed to death on his bed before he could get her to a doctor. And then he tiptoed out of his bedroom and shut the door behind him. He sat down on the sofa in front of the television and wondered what he had done.
Chapter 2. He is somewhere deep beneath the ground, in a tunnel, perhaps, or a sewer. Light comes in flickers, defining the darkness, not dispelling it. He's not alone. There are other people walking beside him, although he cannot see their faces. They are running now through the inside of the sewer, splashing through the mud and filth. Droplets of water fall slowly through the air, crystal clear in the darkness. He turns a corner, and the beast is waiting for him. It is huge. It fills the space of the sewer, massive head down, a bristled body and breath steaming in the chill of the air. Some kind of boar, he thinks at first, and then realizes that that must be nonsense. No boar could be so huge. It is the size of a bull, of a tiger, of a car. It stares at him, and it pauses for 100 years while he lifts his spear. He glances at his hand holding the spear and observes that it is not his hand. The arm is furred with dark hair. The nails are almost claws. And then the beast charges. He throws his spear, but it is already too late, and he feels the beast slice his side with razor-sharp tusks, feels his life slip away into the mud, and he realizes he has fallen face down into the water, which crimsons in thick swirls of suffocating blood. And he tries so to scream, he tries to wake up, but he can breathe only mud and blood and water. He can feel only pain.
"Bad dream?" asked the girl. Richard sat up on the couch, gasping for breath. The curtains were still drawn, the lights and the television still on, but he could tell from the pale light coming in through the cracks that it was morning. He fumbled on the couch for the remote control, which had wedged itself into the small of his back during the night, and turned off the television.
"Yes," he said, "sort of."
He wiped away the sleep grit that crusted his eyes and took stock of himself, pleased to notice that he had at least taken off his shoes and jacket before he had fallen asleep. His shirt front was covered with dried blood and with dirt. The homeless girl didn't say anything. She looked bad, pale beneath the grime and brown dried blood, and small. She was dressed in a variety of clothes thrown over each other. Odd clothes, dirty velvets, muddy lace, rips and holes through which other layers and styles could be seen. She looked, Richard thought, as if she'd done a midnight raid on the History of Fashion section of the Victoria and Albert Museum, and was still wearing everything she'd taken. Her short hair was filthy, but looked like it might have been a dark reddish colour under the dirt. If there was one thing Richard really hated, it was people who stated the obvious. The kind of people who came up to him and said things that he was incapable of failing to notice for himself, such as, for example, "It's raining," or
the bottom just dropped out of your shopping bag and your food just fell into that puddle. Or even, "Oh, I bet that hurts."
"You're up then," said Richard, and hated himself.
"Whose barony is this?" asked the girl. "Whose fiefdom?"
Sorry?
She looked around her suspiciously. "Where am I?"
"Flat 4, Newton Mansions, Little Comden Street."
He stopped. She had opened the curtains, blinking at the cold daylight.
The girl stared out at the rather ordinary view from Richard's window, astonished, peering wide-eyed at the cars and the buses and the tiny sprawl of shops, a newsagent's, a baker's, a chemist's, and an off-licensed liquor store below them.
"I'm in London above," she said, in a small voice.
"Yes, you're in London," said Richard.
"Above what?" he wondered.
"I think maybe you were in shock or something last night. That was a nasty cut on your arm."
He waited for her to say something to explain. She glanced at him and then looked back down at the buses and the shops.
Richard continued, "I found you on the pavement. There was rather a lot of blood."
"Don't worry," she said seriously. "Most of the blood was someone else's."
She let the curtain fall back. Then she began to unwrap the scarf, now blood-stained and crusted, from her arm. She examined the cut and made a face.
"We're going to have to do something about this," she said. "Do you want to give me a hand?"
Richard was beginning to feel a little out of his depth.
"I don't really know too much about first aid," he said.
"Well," she said, "if you're really squeamish, you only have to hold the bandages and tie the bits I can't reach. You do have bandages, don't you?"
Richard nodded.
"Oh, yes," he said, "in the first aid box, in the bathroom, under the sink." And then he went into his bedroom and changed his clothes and wondered whether the mess on his shirt, his best shirt bought for him by, oh God, Jessica, she would have kittens, would ever come off.
The bloody water reminded him of something. Some kind of dream he had once had, perhaps, but he could no longer for the life of him remember exactly what. He pulled the plug, let the water out of the sink, and filled it with clean water again, to which he added a cloudy splash of Dettol liquid disinfectant. The sharp antiseptic smell seemed so utterly sensible and medicinal, a remedy for the oddness of his situation and his visitor. The girl leaned over the sink, and he splashed warm water over her arm and shoulder. Richard was never as squeamish as he thought he was. Or rather, he was astonishingly squeamish when it came to blood on screen. A good zombie movie or even an explicit medical drama would leave him huddled in a corner, hyperventilating, with his hands over his eyes, muttering things like, "Just tell me when it's over." But when it came to real blood, real pain, he simply got on and did something about it. They cleaned out the cut, which was much less severe than Richard remembered it from the night before, and bandaged it up, and the girl did her very best not to wince in the process. And Richard found himself wondering how old she was, and what she looked like under the grime, and why she was living on the streets, and...
"What's your name?" she asked.
"Richard. Richard Mayhew. Dick."
She nodded, as if she were committing it to memory.
The doorbell rang. Richard looked at the mess in the bathroom and the girl and wondered how it would look to a sensible outside observer, such as, for example...
"Oh, Lord," he said, realizing the worst. "I bet it's Jess. She's going to kill me."
Damage control. Damage control. "Look," he told the girl, "you wait in here." He shut the door of the bathroom behind him and walked down the hall. He opened the front door and breathed a huge and quite heartfelt sigh of relief.
"It wasn't Jessica. It was...
what? Mormons? Jehovah's Witnesses? The police?" He couldn't tell. There were two of them, at any rate. They wore black suits, which were slightly greasy, slightly frayed. And even Richard, who counted himself among the sartorially dyslexic, felt there was something odd about the cut of the coats, They were the kind of suits that might have been made by a tailor 200 years ago who had had a modern suit described to him, but had never actually seen one. The lines were wrong, and so were the grace notes. A